Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Claire Jones about the business of birth control, contraception and commerce in Britain before the sexual revolution. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
This is a fascinating and fabulously interesting book, both actually as a history book, but also I think it's a cracking read for the general reader.
That's good to know.
No, it is. Yeah, it reads really really well. It's probably worth saying up front that parts of it are absolutely hilarious too, which, you know, is quite unusual for a history book, I guess. And I suppose it's like part of your broader agenda to say that we should think about things like the history of science, history of medicine through, if not a kind of primary kind of business lens, but we should definitely take into account both commerce and I guess materiality as well. And I'm interested to start there, really. Why did you choose to kind of tell a story of what I guess is kind of sexual practices at the beginning of the 20th century through the lens of firms and commerce?
Yeah, I think, as you say, it's been a kind of mission of mine, really, to integrate the history of business and commerce into history of science and medicine. And I think history of birth control is a really important and fascinating case in this, because when people tend to think about the history of birth control, they think of the medical profession, the kind of birth control movement, even the intervention of the state into increasing provision. But a few people have really taken seriously companies in the commercial element. So what I try and do in this book is bring that to the forefront and not just say that, you know, commercial companies were important, but they were integral and integrated into the birth control movement itself, to the point where the boundaries between what is medicine and what is commerce are very blurred, and it's not clear at all that medicine was more knowledgeable about birth control than companies. And in fact, companies are the ones in the market long before the medical profession want to get involved in birth control. And in a lot of cases, the medical profession rely on companies for their knowledge on the best birth control techniques and technologies. So actually, what I'm trying to do with this book is shift it from a medical story, if you like, to a commercial one, or more precisely, a mixed one. And when you do that, and hopefully what I've done in the book, is reveal that medicalization is itself an important form of rhetoric. So in the interwar period in particular, the medical profession are trying to gain control and assert their authority in birth controls in ways that they haven't done previously. And so obviously, there's a form of rhetoric that surrounds that to say that this is what birth control should look like, and it's based on medical knowledge, and it's based on laboratory testing and clinical testing and scientific standardization. But firms, they can't do that without the company knowledge and the technologies that the companies provide.
The other thing is probably worth flagging quite early on in your kind of quest to reorientate the story, to take business and commerce kind of seriously, is because this is a book about the British and, you know, contraceptive habits, we've, you know, got to think about morality, respectability, the kind of, you know, sort of classic, I guess, policing of certain kind of boundaries around sex in the period. And it'd be good actually to do a bit of scene setting about, on the one hand, you've got, you know, the story of commerce, but also you've also got the story of struggles for, like, what is respectable and what is, like, acceptable as a way of kind of communicating and talking about sex in British society at the time.
Well, I think this is not just a story about birth control, but it's a story about temporality and about the interwar period in particular. And the interwar period is extremely interesting because it's what, you know, Harold Perkin calls this halfway house between the kind of Victorian Edwardian moral sensibility and all quite conservative sexual attitudes. I mean, of course, people were having sex in the Victorian Edwardian period, but the discourse surrounding sex was small and almost non-existent in the public realm, really. But at the same time, you've got that kind of those attitudes rubbing up against new post-First World War attitudes and an optimistic version of the future built on science, technology and medicine, and this idea that people are all modern in the interwar period, and this very kind of progressive look at sex, divorced, birth control and sex divorced from reproduction, as it were. Obviously still among married couples largely, but this idea that sex can be fun and that sex and reproduction don't have to come together. So the interwar period is this period where these two kind of attitudes towards birth control and sex rub up against each other, pardon the pun, quite uncomfortably, with these kind of moralists rejecting any kind of sexual expression, and birth control movement, the medical profession starting, and others, the Bloomsbury set, for example, trying to become more sexually expressive. And in the middle of this, you've got companies trying to navigate how best to sell their contraceptive products. So the way in which they do this, and this is something that I explore very much in the book, is trying to make their products visible, but at the same time make them invisible. So by that I mean using euphemistic terms like surgical appliances. It's only really from the 1920s that birth control appliances is actually starting to be used in advertisements and things like that. Before that, it's domestic specialties or surgical appliances. But those that want these kind of products know what domestic specialties and surgical appliances mean. They know what birth control appliances mean. But those who remain ignorant, or those that don't want to see, can do so. So companies tie this very kind of tightrope, walk this tightrope between this older morality of kind of conservative sexual attitudes and these new modern progressive sexual attitudes, and try and not offend but also make a profit, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I guess that's one of the big things that the second chapter of the book gets into, and actually I should have said maybe early on, you are very into trying to highlight what consumers thought of things. And it might be an interesting question to kind of carry on that line of thought of the tightrope that companies were treading, to think about what consumer responses were to some of these kind of respectable brands for birth control?
I mean, one of the reasons I think a lot of historians have not really discussed consumer attitudes is because evidence is just not there. And it's very difficult to uncover really what consumers were thinking. And that's what I really try and uncover. And in the second chapter in particular, as you say, I do look at this, and I was very fortunate enough to find an existing archive, the archive of Rendall, which was established in 1885 as a soluble pessary maker and seller, and they were called the Wife's Friend. Now, the company still exists, which is fascinating. They don't sell soluble pessaries made out of quinine and cocoa butter anymore to the British market, but they do license the Wife's Friend to the Chinese market. So there's an interesting kind of current story there about contraceptive cultures across the world. But anyway, within this archive of Rendall, the Wife's Friend, again, that's a euphemistic term that women, married women who want a contraceptive product know what the Wife's Friend means. In this archive, there's a whole series of testimonials from different consumers giving their opinion of this Wife's Friend product from the 1940s, largely. And what's, I think, most interesting and comes out of this is their attachment to the brand, the Wife's Friend, and not only the brand, but the trademark, the numbered trademark of the brand. And these consumers are very worried about imitation. Lots of companies enter the market once a contraceptive is popular and start to imitate. So there's all sorts of Wife's Friend that pop up from the late 19th century onwards. And because it's trademarked, Rendall often takes them to court for that. But a lot of judges don't really want to deal with what they think is quite a seedy business. So some of them don't actually make it to trial, and some of them don't go in Rendall's favour because it's very difficult to prove original ownership, particularly in print, for all sorts of complicated legal reasons, which is a bit boring. But the point is, the consumers are very concerned about imitation. So these letters talk about, say, thank you for your product. I've been using it with success for 50 years or 20 years. I've recommended it to my friends, but I'm worried about this imitation. I tried to buy them at this shop and the box didn't have your number on it. Can you tell me whether this is a proper product? So what comes out of this really is it's not really about efficacy and reliability of the product. These consumers think these products, believe these products are effective and have used them effectively for however long, even though throughout my kind of medical science, these things are not effective spermicides. They're just not. They don't pass any tests. But consumers believe in them and very much rely on company goodwill, company reputation and branding and trademarks to navigate the market and purchase what they believe to be a good product against these fraudulent imitations that come on. So that's something that's missed when you only look at the medical side of the story, when you think, okay, is this an effective spermicide? Yes or no? It's almost a moot point. These consumers have used them effectively, even though they fail laboratory tests. And the branding, as I say, and packaging and brand and trademarks are one of the crucial things for these consumers.
You flagged actually, I guess, a point about changing attitudes, both, you know, within kind of society at large, but also in things like, you know, kind of courtroom settings or consumer attitudes. But also the book tries to get to grips with a profound, I guess, technological or manufacturing change for contraceptives. And hearing you talk about the kind of effectiveness or not and things like, you know, the kind of medical effectiveness of a particular product as a spermicide or not, made me think of quite early on in the book where you talk about, is it sort of two methods of making contraception, you know, sort of modern and traditional? And actually thinking about some of the illustrations, the pictures throughout the book give a real sense of, you know, the rise of a distinctly modern, both in terms of materials, but also in terms of manufacturing and testing practices, mode of making contraceptives. So what's the story of kind of contraceptive production, the kind of the material of contraceptives during the interwar era?
So in the interwar period, in the 1930s specifically, we get latex rubber manufacturing, which is a distinctly new rubber process, which allows companies to produce condoms in particular more easily and more quickly and more cheaply. So there's obvious benefits to us, to them, and why they might go down the latex manufacturing route. And it's also, I should say, safer. There's lots of reports of companies that use the 19th century vulcanization and cement rubber process for production and that end up burning down because it's so dangerous and the chemicals used are really volatile. So latex is safer as well. But I did not want to tell this kind of more traditional story of rubber production revolution, which I think comes across in many histories of contraception. It isn't as simple as that. It's not a case of we have this new production method of latex, which actually as well, you know, is familiar to us. Latex condoms are familiar to us. They're also thinner for the consumer as well. So they are, you know, less interruptive of the sexual act, if you like. But it's not a simple case of we have this new method and now we're going to adopt it. One of the companies I look at called Lambert are in the production business from at least the 1860s and stick with cement manufacturing until the 1940s and 50s at least. And that's because they've already got a foothold in the market for the more traditional rubber production methods and their contraceptives. So why would they change it? Because latex production is extremely expensive to buy the machinery in the first place. There's no guarantee that the market is there. If you've already got a market for rubber contraceptives, why change it? So there's a suggestion that consumers prefer these existing contraceptive products rather than the new one. So what I argue actually that this idea of a revolution in contraceptive manufacturing is also one that's rhetorically made up by the medical profession in the 1930s, who are trying to get on board with latex condoms and production themselves. So it's in their interest to sell this as a revolution because they become involved in it. And they become involved in it through the introduction of standardized testing. And so some of the pictures that you referred to in the first chapter show companies trying to navigate these new rigorous standardized testings of their rubber goods. So you have one guy dangling a condom from a chair, or dangling a chair from a condom, should I say, to try and test its strength and its stretchability. And you have a couple of other guys sitting at a workbench blowing up condoms to check that they don't have holes in. So these new standards become important, becoming integral to supply birth control clinics and medical practitioners that start to get involved in the late 1920s, 1930s onwards. So once these kind of latex products start to become popular, you see more companies start to adopt them. So it's the other way around, really. It's a demand-led market. So the latex revolution didn't really hit the market, I'd say, until about 10, 20 years after the technique is introduced. So I think that's what's different about my story.
If we talked about business, talked a bit about consumers, I suppose like the kind of maybe third set of actors here are medics. And I'm drawing that really kind of broadly, both in terms of, you know, from as wide as like, you know, doctors or clinics, right the way through to things like chemists, actually. And there's a really fascinating discussion of chemists as a, you know, sort of respectable, almost, you know, kind of new profession with regards to contraception. Well, I'm interested in medics because I suppose the sort of, and you've alluded to this already, you know, the validation of these products as being effective consumer, you know, kind of confidence is in some ways, you know, sort of helped by medics, but is in other ways, you know, kind of threatened or, you know, is questioned by medics. So what's the story of medicine, particularly, I guess, the kind of story of how the clinic was as much a site of commerce as it was a site of medicine?
Yeah, I think the story of the birth control clinic is a very interesting one and probably something that historians of contraception have paid most attention to because they become an emblem, if you like, a site of birth control practice and knowledge and a technological distribution. But again, as with everything, I try to complicate the picture. It's not just, you know, the birth control movement opened lots of clinics and drove, promoted contraceptive use, and that's how people started using contraception. I mean, for a start, we know that clinic attendance was not that high, and was largely largely middle class women that attended the clinics, even though the kind of birth control pioneers like Marie Stopes and the Family Planning Association had those that could not afford to go elsewhere for contraception. So like working class women in particular to use the clinics. So the picture of the birth control clinic as just a place of contraception is where the revolution in birth control started is just not entirely accurate, I would argue. But where they are important is when is for kind of medical knowledge and education in contraceptive issues to start. And so you think about the medical curriculum in the interwar period, there is nothing in the medical school curriculum about contraception. So any doctor that is interested in helping their patients with contraception have nowhere else to go but the birth control clinic. So it's an interesting educational setting as well. But they're also, I argue, sites of commerce, right? So companies obviously benefited massively by supplying clinics, but also, as I say, but numbers of supply weren't that high. But reputationally, as products became associated with clinics and with the medical profession, custom beyond the clinic was enhanced. So business was enhanced just through the reputation of being associated with a clinic, not just being associated with a clinic, but also having a reputation of passing all these spermicidal efficacies and rubber testing, all these tests that began to be a prerequisite of being suppliers of these clinics. So these clinics were so important reputationally to the industry, the contraceptive industry, that companies began to establish their own clinics and were not entirely honest all the time that they were, you know, commercially run for profit. So a lot of times consumers or patients weren't clear which was a Family Planning Association clinic and which was a clinic established by a company just solely that supplied one company's products. So again, this is an example of the blurring between medicine and commerce. But what I should also say as well about the clinic is that, you know, medical practitioners are not, were not themselves devoid from the influence of commerce. Even with the introduction of more rigorous rubber testing and spermicidal testing, lots of practitioners still relied on products that failed such tests. So this idea of reliability and efficacy of contraceptives based on laboratory and clinical standardized testing only really had an impact in the 1950s. Previously, you hear there's records of individual doctors and individual clinics saying, well, you know, I know this product failed the test, but we have been using them for 20 years and they are a good company, or as honest as business permits, as one of the subtitles of the chapter is called. So I'm going to continue using them. So a lot of the time medics reject their own scientific standards to, again, rely on company reputation, company relationships and goodwill. So again, this just underscores the importance of the commercial angle, and it's not just about medical testing and laboratory testing.
What about chemists? And I think I think particularly just thinking about, you know, we talked about the materiality of concept of production, changes in is rubber technology a word? But you know, the transformations of the era. I was really struck by a discussion of a device with regard to chemists, which was the slot machine, and I suppose that points us towards where we're going to conclude, which is to do with a modern or contemporary discussion. But what's the story of the slot machine? Because that is, you know, certainly for male contraceptives, this, you know, almost kind of iconic device that is now almost inseparable from the story of things like condom use, for example.
Yeah, I think the slot machine is a really fascinating example of a technology used to sell another technology, and or at least be promote it. So, I mean, the slot machine is a technology that's used more generally to sell chocolate or railway tickets, train tickets, from about 1900. But it's really in the interwar period that a certain aggressive contraceptive and specifically condom manufacturers and distributors start to use slot machines as a way to sell their condoms. And for them, it's a great selling device because there's no need for a shopkeeper. There's no need for, open and closed hours. They're just available established on the street corner or outside a chemist shop if the chemist owns the slot machine. And people can put in something like a penny, two penny for a condom and at any hour of the day and not be kind of judged by the shop owner or the shopkeeper. So it's a very discreet and personal way of buying condoms at any time. So there's obvious benefits for both supplier and consumer, but these kind of slot machines that are largely kind of put in street corners on major cities, so there's lots in London and a handful in places like Leeds, Leicester, they're obviously very, very visible, and they're too visible for social conservatives, moral associations like the Public Morality Council, and they kind of are up in arms about how awful the erection of these machines on street corners are for the public morals of the country, and that they sort of, one of the key things that they're concerned about is access by unmarried youths who are then going to use these things, and it's kind of the downfall of society through the promiscuous use, having sex outside marriage. So it becomes almost a moral panic surrounding these vending machines. And this is quite heavily debated across different organisations, the church, MPs and Parliament. And there isn't any good way to restrict access to these machines for certain individuals while allowing legitimate consumers, if you like, which are the married by the interwar period, is, you know, it's acceptable for the married to be able to control their own fertility. There's no good way for restricting access to certain members of society. And so nothing really happens. And then the sort of Second World War happens. And by 1949, more machines start to emerge after the Second World War. And that's possibly because of the kind of popularity, the growing popularity of the condom during the Second World War. So eventually in 1949, there's a bylaw that's passed that kind of outlaws slot machines, and then they sort of disappear from Britain's streets by 1950. But what's really interesting, I think, when I go to European cities, I haven't been for quite some time now, unfortunately, but if you go to different European cities, Durex machines are often on street corners. So I've seen them in Paris, Barcelona, Bucharest. They're still there. So they didn't, these other European countries didn't seem to have this tussle, this kind of public battle around slot machines that we had in Britain, around respectability and promiscuity and all these kinds of issues. So I think that's really, really quite interesting. And how chemists come into this story is the same kind of debates are about chemist window displays. As chemists become more like retailers and less like the, you know, sort of like Boots, they're kind of quasi-pharmacists and quasi-retailers, attracting consumer attention becomes more important, and there's nothing to stop chemists establishing window displays of contraceptive other than kind of, you know, sensibilities, until the 1944 Pharmaceutical Society clause that says you're not allowed to kind of publicly display them. So until then, chemists who are broad church, it's up to them whether they do display contraceptives or not. But again, this whole debate around, well, if you don't display them and if you don't sell them, you are not only damaging British trade, but you're damaging the rights of legitimate consumers to see and purchase these goods. And Lord Dawson, who is a kind of birth control advocate as well as like the royal physician, he's very kind of concerned about the ignorant woman consumer who doesn't really know much about contraceptives, but knows when she sees it in a window display or perhaps in a vending machine what she needs and what she wants. So she would be too embarrassed to ask for it, but she could possibly point at it. So if you restrict these things so that unmarried youths can't get at them, then you also damage the ignorant woman. So that's about it in a nutshell.
And it's funny, I mean, my concluding question was going to be about bringing things into the present, but it's funny how, I mean, there are definitely things in the book, and we haven't really got into this, but you know, the kind of long-running, long strain of eugenic thought around contraception that to the kind of contemporary eyes or contemporary reader is like, oh yes, you know, that we could definitely sort of distance ourselves from that, or, you know, that is absolutely not we, to kind of paraphrase Foucault, you know, that is not we, other kind of interwar individuals or society. But there are definitely some elements where, you know, the analysis, particularly thinking about that relationship between the enabling and the kind of constraining elements of commerce, brings us into the present. And as a kind of concluding point, I'm really interested in what the analysis says now, really. You know, is it something where, do you think, you know, we should be grappling with things like contraception from a much more kind of commercial, almost as a complement to, say, public health, which I guess kind of dominates things like contraception now? Are there, you know, kind of elements of the book that are, dare I say it, like a bit of a kind of, you know, a reminder of a particularly kind of problematic or, you know, really difficult history that we assume has been left behind, but actually, you know, is maybe still with us when we think about contraception in contemporary British society?
There's quite a lot to that question. So I'm just thinking, I mean, certainly
the past is dead in a foreign country and we can learn nothing from it.
Well, as a historian, I have to say yes and no. And it's more complicated than that, as per usual. But I would say that we still have a very pluralistic marketplace when it comes to contraception, right? So medicine plays an important part. For the provision of things like, you know, IUDs and the contraceptive pill, but also the market for condoms. You can get them at supermarkets. Durex is still a huge brand that originates in the interwar period. So we do have that pluralistic market still. And I think what's interesting and what I try and argue in the end of the book is that the emergence of the contraceptive pill in the 1960s almost gives the impression and creates this rhetoric that it's all been medicalized and always has been, which is simply not the case. So where do we go? I also think that we still have this very moralistic view around contraceptive and still who has access. I mean, there's still some kind of reservations about the distribution of contraceptive to school, teenagers by certain groups. And, you know, we haven't even really touched upon abortion, which I don't really touch upon in the book because I definitely wanted to avoid that whole issue, which could be a book in itself. But one of the examples I do bring up, and that is actually relates to the work of some great sociologists at the University of Kent on the morning after pill. Even the word the morning after pill is not really is a colloquialism that shouldn't really be used. It's more the emergency contraception as well kind of evokes this fear, you know, around contraceptive use. And this idea that you can't just buy an emergency contraceptive pill over the counter, that you have to go to a pharmacist and, you know, be subjected to a series of questions about your sexual relationships to obtain this pill, still highlights this kind of moralistic view on contraceptive consumption. And some of the work of my sociologist colleagues say that there's absolutely no kind of pharmaceutical or scientific reason that you shouldn't be able to buy this pill. There's no safety concerns around it. It's actually societal constructions around what is respectable and what's not. So for me, that's really interesting and shows us more about the continuities around respectability and moral concerns surround contraception. And just lastly, I think, because you've alluded to it, and something that I haven't really discussed is the eugenic kind of strand that runs through this. And Marie Stopes, obviously a prominent interwar eugenicist and a leading figure in the birth control movement and a clinic pioneer. But you know, some of the stuff that she advocated is pretty morally repugnant to our eyes, I would say. But at the same time, she believed that all women, especially working class women, should be able to control their fertility, and mainly that those women who'd already had children shouldn't be kind of, their bodies and their minds shouldn't be kind of subjected to having any more. So, I mean, some of the book goes into, she was quite a character, which I think comes across, I hope, Dave.
That's one way of putting it, yeah.
And you know, the eugenics strain of it comes through in the naming of contraceptives. So one of her contraceptives, which she worked on a company to produce, is called the racial. One is called the pro race. So these wider population concerns about getting the fittest of the population to reproduce, while at the same time stopping those less desirable through the widespread distribution of contraception to the less desirable. So, the eugenics angle is always kind of under the surface there, especially when we talk about Marie Stopes. But there were a lot of people in the interwar period, you know, the Flammy Planning Clinic, who had to deal with Marie Stopes because she was such an important pioneer. But also wanted to distance themselves from some of the things that she did and thought. So there is nuance there. It's not one kind of straightforward eugenic view, as it were.
I'm glad you sort of mentioned, you know, that there's all kinds of things in the book that we haven't even touched on, and obviously I recommend people buy and read the book. You know, it said at the start, it's both, you know, kind of a fascinating read as well as, I think, an important intervention into the historiography of both, you know, things like history of medicine, but also history of the period as well. What are you thinking in terms of your next project? I mean, it's always a bit sort of harsh to ask someone who's just finished a book to be like, well, that's, you know, lovely, but it's finished now. What are you doing next? But what are you doing next? Are you thinking, for example, you know, you mentioned that there probably is, you know, a book on abortion, or actually, you know, that book might have been done by other scholars. There's, you know, certainly you could extend this analysis, I think, really richly and rewardingly into the period of, as the book's title kind of alludes to, the sexual revolution. In the 1960s and 1970s, or maybe you're just, you know, really tired of talking about condoms and would like to do something entirely different.
Yeah. I mean, there is an element of that. So it's taken a long time to write this book, just purely to have the time and sit down and do it. So I'm really pleased that I've finally done it. So there is an element of kind of fatigue about it, but there are loads of areas within the book that I'd like to expand, particularly around, I think, the print culture stuff. I've only really touched the surface on the print culture angle, so the kind of production of medical books around contraception, but also their imitation by companies that tried to disguise their advertising by making them look like medical books, medical textbooks around contraception. So I had to take a lot out, particularly of that chapter around the print culture stuff. So I'd like to do a bit more of that. I think there's also more to say about consumption, and certainly the Marie Stopes correspondence, there's, you know, 10,000 letters or so that I didn't go through systematically. And I think there's more to say on consumption through that correspondence. I don't really want to go too much into the sexual revolution because there's a number of great scholars already doing really good work on that. So I might leave that. But I am still really keen on the topic and think that there's more to be said and done on it more generally. I just need to have a bit more of a think about that. But beyond contraception, I'm now looking at teeth and oral health, and specifically how kind of the rise of oral health regimes and the practices of toothbrushing become almost kind of accepted. So in the 1920s, even, very few people had a toothbrush. In the 1940s, one in two people had a toothbrush. So what's going on there? What happened? I'm really interested in that. And again, it's a story of medical intervention, state intervention, and commercial intervention. So I guess I'm just writing the same book with toothbrushes.